Welcome to the Momentum Matters podcast, where we have courageous conversations with women leaders. You'll hear about their accomplishments, their experiences, challenges, and best advice. If you're inspired by women who've overcome barriers and gone on to do extraordinary things, you're in the right place. My name is Karen Tarotis, and I'm the CEO of Social You, a digital marketing firm specializing in social media management, training, and consulting. Today on Momentum Matters, we're excited to introduce Dr. Lindsay Sutton, a behavioral designer and performance strategist working across Birmingham to promote inclusive management strategies. We'll hear about her inspiring backstory, her journey navigating the corporate landscape as a queer woman and creating spaces for LGBTQ plus youth in tech. Now, here's our host, April Benitolo, CEO of Momentum Leaders, a youth-based nonprofit on a mission to advance women in leadership.
Good afternoon, and Dr. Lindsay Sutton, thank you so much for being in with us today at Momentum for our Momentum Matters podcast, which this month is going to be focused specifically on for Pride Month, yes, on guests from the LGBTQ community. So we're super
very
happy
excited
that you came on line with us to talk, and let's get started. What I'd like to do is we generally start these podcasts by talking through, like, mm-hmm, what was your path as a woman and as a rising leader in your field? What was your path to leadership, and kind of how did your upbringing affect your path to leadership? And then once we kind of get to that place, I want to specifically move into the topic of where does gender equity, mm-hmm, and the LGBTQ community kind of intersect, and what does that look like sort of to the larger community and in the workplace? But let's start with little Lindsay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I am so thankful that I'm here first, and happy Pride to everyone. This month is my favorite month, not only my birth month, but it is Pride month. So I have so much to be thankful and so much to be proud about. But yeah, I think I want to get a little vulnerable with your audience here, and maybe talk about things that I haven't really disclosed or talked about publicly. But I think as I've evolved as a leader, I have realized that my mess has become my message, that I have used my pain and I have turned it into my power, that my breakdowns throughout life have turned into breakthroughs. And I hope that that will resonate even with some of the people that are kind of tuning in and listening or on the leadership path, on their own leadership path. Yeah. A lot of people don't know about my upbringing. I am the product of a single mother. I had an absentee father. He was not around at all. He kind of abandoned his family. He started a new family. I was the victim of severe emotional and physical abuse as a child by the hands of my stepmother. It was a very difficult time in my life and a very hard thing to overcome. I had my first bout with depression when I was 16, but felt like I remember having suicidal ideation far before that because of abuse. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, experienced, I, as a child, I really invested heavily into sports and academia as an outlet. And I think that I learned the struggle and what scarcity felt like at a very young age. Growing up with a child, you know, with a mother, a single mother who, look, she did the absolute best she could. But I, you know, being a child, I'm not even sure I was above the poverty line at that time. Living on a single income and her just working as hard as she could to provide for us. So when I think about all these things and being a researcher, being a scientist, doing the things that I do, statistics say that I should have hardly graduated high school. I should have coped with drugs potentially. maybe I would have been, had an unwanted pregnancy early on, probably recreated an abusive relationship because of what I experienced, had serious mental health issues that probably went unchecked. And I actually had none of that, right? Even with experiencing depression and anxiety as a young child, I found help. And I have worked diligently to use that and turn that pain into power. So statistically speaking, when we think about what the research says about all of those factors, or children growing up in those environments, I should not have gone to, let alone graduated from, a top 20 university on scholarship, right?
Right.
Right. I should not have gotten 3 advanced degrees. I should not have been able to start my own business, and not one, but several, right? So being a business owner is something that I've thoroughly enjoyed. If you believed those statistics, I shouldn't be remotely influential in my industry. I would have sunk a lot sooner.
So what do you think brought you through all of that?
As I have experienced my time with you and other leaders, which has been so impactful in my life, I actually realize it's because one woman truly believed in me in an unwavering way. She never let me quit, never let me think I couldn't have it all. My mother, like, she's been my cheerleader and my champion since day one, and absolutely a refuge. So I had a great example, and I know the power of even one woman believing in you,
yeah,
and realize how important that is. So when we talk about things like gender equity, and we talk about, you know, especially when we talk about LGBTQ plus women, there is so much power in our camaraderie when we come together and support each other.
Yeah. Well, there's collective power in all humans.
Yeah.
But there is a special kind that happens when it is a specific group of people that understand the challenges that other people like them are going through. So then you get the subset of humankind that is women, and then the subset of that is LGBTQ+.
Absolutely.
And then maybe even within that, you have further subsets of those who had an abusive past or those kind of things. So yeah, that really opens up the conversation in new ways, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, like I said, the person people see now is someone who overcame all of that, who worked hard, who found support, who networked and found the resources that I needed to be more effective, to show up more authentically, to be my true self.
Yeah.
And I found that not only in camaraderie with men, but also with women who believed in my professional potential, who believed in my personal potential.
Yes.
So there is power in our connection, and that is one of the things that, you know, we are built for these social connections. They matter. And finding our tribe is absolutely important.
Mm-hmm. So do you mind sharing with us, when did you come to that point where you were okay maybe coming out to those who were just very close around you versus actually embracing authentically your whole self into the public space? Because you've been in the public space for a while.
I have been in the public space for a while. I probably came out in my 20s. I knew way before that. It just, you know, you're a kid. You're like, is this real? What am I doing? Who am I? I didn't have a lot of examples around me to know, is this socially acceptable? What does this mean? How do I process this? But I formally came out in my 20s, and my mother didn't skip a beat. My family didn't skip a beat. If they have taught me anything, it is the power of also unconditional love.
And you have siblings.
I do have siblings. I have an older brother. I have a younger sister. And then I have 4 half brothers.
Okay.
So we have a very large family. And of my siblings, my family has never skipped a beat. And I want to say that my experience does not represent at all what most LGBTQ plus people experience when they come out. We're witnessing homelessness in teenagers. We're witnessing devastation and resources being pulled and support being pulled. I mean, this is a very real thing that has very far-reaching implications. That was not my experience. My family was absolutely loving, supportive, and 100%, the question has only ever been, are you happy?
That's awesome. That's really great.
Yeah. Are you happy? That's it.
Well, I mean, in a childhood of some misfortune, to have that is huge. And like you said, you need one person and you need that one thread of acceptance that you can hang on to sometimes makes just all the difference.
I agree. It's an opportunity. When they showed me that, it showed me how to behave, right? And even in these early, even in the early environment, we learn so much from the things that happen to us, and we can stay stuck and we can stay in that kind of scarcity mindset of it all, or the a victim mindset, or we can say, look, I have got to take this and make it powerful for me. And yeah, I haven't had the experience with my family that I've heard so many very terrible stories.
So for you as a leader, when you hear those very terrible stories, but it is not the experience that you had, what advice do you have for those individuals who maybe didn't have that same lifeline?
I've had the opportunity to hear those stories. I've heard the whispers, and I've heard, and I've seen the tears, and I've been on the receiving end of the SOSs. Like, these are, can get to very critical situations. But my goal is always to be a radical empath in that place and make sure I leverage and activate my resources and networks. If there's a basic need not being met, there's a ton of community resources that I lean on, that I stay in touch with just to make sure that I'm active in, volunteer for, fundraise for, to make sure that there are always resources available. But in a professional setting, when, particularly in a professional setting, when I have women or gay men or junior engineers or whatever role that they start filling and they start realizing who I am, they realize pretty quickly I'm authentically open. That was really important to me, because when I looked around and and looked for safe spaces, I was woefully disappointed. Mm-hmm. So I became one. I became the space that people could come to. And I try to stay so accessible and make sure I'm an open book, and engage actively in my own skills. Am I listening well? Am I not trying to solve their problems, but really understand? Like, trying to make sure I am still a safe space for people.
Yeah.
So that they can feel free to come to me.
And I bet that has impacted, or at least influenced, your leadership style at large. You know, so can you talk a little bit more about that, how you embracing authentically who you are, you being a safe space for others, and how that has influenced how you lead in a business sense, how you lead in a community sense?
Absolutely. I think people who have engaged with me in that dynamic or that relationship would probably say there's little, you know, we know what she's thinking. We know what she's thinking, and we know how she's going to respond. I'm pretty business
first. Mystery is not your
thing. Yeah, mystery is not my thing. And I think that's really intentional, given the environment, given the feeling that there are still conversations happening in the dark that need to happen in the light, and need to happen on the stage, and need to be brought forward. Yeah. So I am just very intentional about diversity being in on my projects, in the rooms, on my teams. And diversity for me is that I feel like there's levels of diversity. There's first order diversity, and that's really that gut reaction of, hey, you look male or female, you look of a race or ethnicity. Like, those snap judgments we make, that's how our brains work, right? So you're like, okay, I think there's, you know, enough diversity in the room. But then there's a second order diversity. Those are the things we don't see: the expertise, the skills, the experience, the education, the hobbies, the, oh, you know, what were your experiences like?
sexuality is somewhere in the mix of that, because some people never really bring it to light and other people are open. Yeah. And then third order is all the stuff I led this conversation with. All of the stuff, our path, our story, that we can choose to never share. But we bring all of that when we show up at work.
That's right.
We're not, there's not pieces we leave at home. There's not pieces we can kind of carve out, set on the shelf, and I'll be back later. I'll come get you later after I do the work thing.
Yeah.
Right? So we bring all that. And I am very intentional as a leader as getting to know what motivates you. What do you care about? What should we care about? What are you reading?
Right.
What do you do for fun? Are you a scotch drinker? Like, I don't know. Like, or are you a beer drinker? Or you don't drink?
Or do you work out?
Or do you work out? Yeah. Because there is so much, there is so much power in even those small details. We, like I said, we have an innate need. It is a basic need for us to feel socially connected. It is as basic as food, water, and shelter.
Yeah.
We want to be seen and we want to be heard. So how are you making sure your team and the people on your team are seen and heard?
Mm-hmm.
I read a study recently as we're talking about this that said 40% of people don't feel like they physically or emotionally belong at work.
Wow.
They feel excluded. This was 2019 when this study was done. So this was pre-COVID. This was not COVID.
Yeah.
And it blew my mind.
Yeah.
If we know that this is an innate human need, we've got 4 out of 10 of our employees who feel like they don't belong. That's a problem.
That's a big problem.
That's a huge problem.
And this is where, you know, more recently at Momentum, we've started working with the men
mm-hmm.
who are executives in some of the largest employers in order to say, for 20 years, we've been helping women work on themselves.
Yeah.
Women gain the confidence, women gain the skills. Now it's time to address the workplace itself.
That's exactly right.
You know, and that kind of leads me into the next topic, which is, how do you see that intersectionality between when we talk about gender equity in the workplace for women in general and what that can feel like for them? And you've been through Momentum, so you were in a room full of
I loved it.
Largely cisgender women, right?
Very much
heterosexual
so.
Women.
As far as I know.
As far as I know. But hearing, you know, some very similar things to, I'm sure, some of the things that you have dealt with in your life. However, there have been other things that, of course, you have dealt with that they have not dealt with. So mm-hmm. I'm really interested in that overused word of intersectionality. But yes, yeah. Where do these things cross paths? And, you know, it's kind of what is your take on it?
Yeah, I think there's a, it's really interesting. As I think about the topic, this, you know, knowing this, you know, we were going to have this talk, I've been, you know, really intentional, really chewing on these ideas and reflecting back on times in my experiences. And I didn't, you know, fully have the words for it until now, which is interesting. But there still is a undercurrent of sexism and now a level of heterosexism that occurs in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
So I have often... surprise, I don't, you know, if we think about stereotypical gay women, I don't look like a stereotypical gay woman. And I've actually had my gay women friends be like, you don't look gay, you know? But I've had people in the workplace when we have public events or, hey, we're doing a picnic or the Christmas party, are you going to bring your boyfriend?
Uh-huh.
Just make the assumption, which is that idea that this is normal, that everyone's heterosexual. Of course, the answer is no. No, I'm not, actually.
I might bring my friend.
Yeah. So then it turns into, well, do I feel safe with this person to let them know?
Right.
So one of the things we have to think through, and it is one of the challenging things, I think, is we do have to address our own biases and our own communication around it. Do we embrace the bias that this heterosexism stream or current exists?
Mm-hmm.
And are we propagating it in our communications even? We had a discussion around language last week. Hey, even in your communications, or... Are you saying, hey, bring your spouse, bring your husbands and wives, whatever it is? Does it feel very
heteronormative, or is it bring your partners?
Right.
Right? Yeah. Bring your significant other.
There are, bring whoever you bring like.
Whoever, bring a cat. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, bring or don't. Whatever. We don't know. Yeah. It is, so it's even in some of the nuance of the language that we realize that both sexism can still be alive, which, you know, that I've experienced that. Absolutely. I absolutely have stories of being the note taker and coffee fetcher when I was the only woman in the room.
Yeah.
And you're just like, actually, it's Dr. Sutton and I called this meeting.
Right.
Right. You were waiting. Thank you for waiting on me. Enjoy your coffee.
Yeah.
So I've experienced it. I've experienced both. Mm-hmm. But again, I can only talk about, you know, as we even think about the other confluence, the other intersectional of race and ethnicity, I can only talk from a white, cisgendered, queer woman's perspective. I can't represent trans women. I can't represent women of color.
Right.
There's so many other factors. And that's why I'm so bent on we have got to connect, build stronger, more meaningful connections, and pull each other into these meetings and onto these teams and make sure there is diversity. And it isn't just we're checking boxes and look, it's diverse. Right. It's the other part I was talking about, the inclusion part. Do you feel like you belong here? I definitely sit on that. If we're talking about the DE&I movement, I'm on the I. Like, do you feel included?
Right, right. It's not enough to be diverse.
Yeah, it isn't.
Inclusion is
it isn't
where it's all about. And that can be for any factor. It could be,
yes,
you know, you didn't go to the right college or you didn't.
I agree.
People are excluded for a whole host of reasons, which I'm really not sure. You're the doctor. You tell me.
I mean,
why do we do that as humans? Why do we have this need to include some and exclude others? I'm really not sure. Speaking of, you shared with me a highly unusual path that you took in your career.
I did.
I want you to talk a little bit about this unusual job.
I did. No one really knows about this either.
Oh, yeah.
I know. I love
That's
it.
Even
look,
better.
Look, this is a tell-all, people. Yeah. You're getting it first here. I after college, I really wanted to understand.
College where you majored in?
Okay, yes. I went to Vanderbilt, still the SEC, Alabama and Auburn fans. I know you don't think it should be there, but it's there. I majored in psychology and sociology with an emphasis in criminology. And I was like, you know what? I really want to see what this is all about. I want to see, I've read all the theories. I've read all the papers. I've read all the textbooks. I want to really see what this is about. So I was actually a corrections officer for 2 years after college, like in between me ending college, graduating, and then going back to school for my PhD and my master's.
And just knowing you and knowing what you have done subsequently, I mean, my mind was blown. You worked at a prison?
I mean, it just was so eye-opening for me to understand, look, you're seeing some people probably the worst place in their lives, or like, I made a huge mistake, I'll never do, and you know, there was definitely repentance they were after. And then there were other people who were just trapped in the system, and it's a revolving door. And then there was complications with substance abuse and complications with mental health. And that's really where I felt like, wow, there's a, we're getting this wrong. We're not,
yes.
This isn't, I don't have the answers, but I feel like this isn't it, you know? And I was like, so I think I want to go back to school and explore why people behave the way they do, why they make the decisions that they do, and how can we shape those decisions more effectively. So it was in school that I really got to deepen my understanding of behavior change and how to create positive experiences that really shape and scaffold the change we really want to see in people.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
Yeah.
I like the shape and scaffold.
Yeah.
So you did your graduate degree at UAB?
I did. I absolutely did. I loved it. What an amazing institution that gave me so many opportunities. And, you know, coming from the reputation and the school that I did, I didn't skip a beat at UAB. So go Blazers.
Awesome. Yeah, that's fantastic. It is a tremendous resource for us in this city and in the
state. It absolutely is. And there is, you know, even as we think about gender equity, you know, kind of coming back to it, LGBTQ equity. I mean, they're starting discussions and providing training and courses. And I mean, they're definitely a mover and shaker in this industry as well.
Yes, absolutely. And so take us from that point to what you are doing today, because I do want you to share with our listeners a little bit about Hidden Innovators and what that work consists of and where you see yourself kind of going from here.
Yeah. So diversity to me is important, you know, and the inclusion part, if I haven't sold that I'm a champion for that. I mean, I'm here for it. Hidden Innovators is my addition to the nomenclature around diversity. I believe we are all creative, hands down. And when I'm working with organizations, whether it's in a coaching or consulting capacity, I know they have the resources to do the things they need to do. They have the people. They hire smart, right? And if we believe that the hiring practices, and I'm going to make the assumption, the hiring practices are diverse enough, right? They're focused on that. It's illegal not to be at this point. So if I believe those things are true, then I went into building Hidden Innovators to say, then you have the resources you need. You have the talent, you have the skills, you have the hobbies, the diverse perspectives, the experiences, all the things are all there. How do you leverage them in the right way? And Hidden Innovators says, hey, how we approach uncertainty is different. We're all creative and we're all capable of problem solving. We do it every day. Like, I'm not going to just let my sink leak. I'm going to troubleshoot it. I'm going to figure it out, right? I'm going to stain my new Adirondack chairs in the back. I'm going to figure it out. I don't know how to stain, but I'm going to figure it out, right? We're all creative in these very unique ways. So Hidden Innovators said, hey, well, let's start capturing what that diversity and that approach is, right? So am I someone who really seeks information first before, when I'm faced with uncertainty or faced with a new problem, do I want to seek information first? Am I someone, so we call them sages, am I someone then who, I'm a doer. I kind of look around, do I have the resources? I'm just going to go. Let me see if I can troubleshoot a solution and then I'll
tinker
learn from that.
Yeah.
They're literally, we call them tinkers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love it. We do because they're just hands-on. That's how they learn.
Yeah.
Right? And the last group that we call is dreamers, because they can imagine the world with all the solutions. Like, there's 1,600 ways we could solve this, you know? Like, think about this, think about that, and look what the world would look like when we solve it, right? And you're like, wow. So we all have the same problem. We just have a different start.
Yeah, different path to get to the solution, yeah.
So if we can start leveraging that diversity, I was telling you a little bit about first order, second order. This is kind of in that second order space.
Right.
It's like, how do I approach uncertainty? What do I do when I'm like, oh, man, I don't know. What do I do with the I don't know?
Yeah.
So it was saying, hey, there's unique ways to put teams together that are super optimal and way more effective, because team building is an art and a science now. Right? It is an art and a science. You're like, oh, we can't predict if people are going to have, you know, conflict, or what if they just rub the wrong way, or there's too much tension. That's what we were saying. We are seeing teams stagnate, not get out of that storming phase. If you endorse the phases of team development, they were just staying stuck. And we were seeing innovation teams, you know, innovation is obviously a huge thing, super necessary, especially in times of COVID and figuring out a rebound strategy. But these innovation teams, what we realized when we were going into these global Fortune 20 companies, is the innovation teams all had one type. They all had one type and no diversity. So they were all going to tinker away.
Yeah.
Right? And like try to build solutions, but I'm going to build a solution from my expertise and you're going to build a solution with your software expertise or your, engineering expertise. And they all just still felt disparate.
Right.
Where I came in as a sage and said, well, who actually has the problem? Let's talk to them. You guys are building in isolation. Yeah. Like, you didn't even ask the person who has the problem.
We see that in software development. Yeah, we see that in engineering.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
So as a sage, I instantly ask different questions. Hey, let me talk to the person who has a problem. And my dreamer was like, well, if we get this solved, we're going to save nearly $500 million. You know, like, this is going to fly. This is going to be more efficient. So our dreamer was already like in that post solution phase. Well, here's what, and then dreamers kind of start backing into it at that point. Well, if this is where we want to be, then da, 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 da. So it was just really, really interesting. But we find that particularly software, particularly academia, companies start hiring for the same type and they don't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're actually stunting diversity
in this creative way.
And stunting the innovation.
Stunting innovation, because right. creativity becomes is literally just blocked at that point, right? We all have to be inspired, but mm-hmm. if we all think the same.
Yeah.
That's right. We're going to keep getting the same solutions over and over again. And each
tinkered things that don't work all the way.
Yeah. And what I have found with Hidden Innovators, as we've been doing this for years now, there are predictable tension points that you can manage for. When sages and dreamers are in a room, I already know where their heads are at. When the issues between tinkerers and sages, tinkerers are go, go, go. Sages are like, whoa,
wait,
pump the brakes.
Let's
pump the brakes. Let's figure this out. Like, maybe someone else has already solved this problem. Let's wait. Right?
So tinkerer does not want to wait.
Tinkerers don't want to wait. They're like, look, that's the
solution. And dreamers are already there.
And dreamers are like, look, can you guys catch up? I'm already over here. I don't know what y'all are talking about.
That's so interesting. So it reminds me so much of some of the work we do in Momentum, where we talk about, you know, the DISC profiles or the Myers-Briggs or whatever profile you want to talk about, but just how do different types of people, depending on the way they're motivated, depending on the way they're wired, how do they bring their best to the team? And
this
how do you design a team that's optimal and uses all of the strengths? But I love the Hidden Innovators, you know, the breakdown of where does that creativity point derive from? How do they progress through the process, and where do you get to?
Well, when it's become even more important because of all the uncertainty that has filled us in this time.
Yeah.
This is and intersectionality might be an unprecedented time. That word, it's unprecedented. We've heard that a lot. This past year.
Only third to COVID and pandemic.
Yeah, right? So how we approach uncertainty and knowing that about ourselves and being able to manage through that effectively, particularly now, is so important.
Mm-hmm.
And the teams that I see that are using it and actually have the nouns and verbs now to talk and say, whoa, you're having a sage moment. I'm going to give you a minute. Or like, hey, do you mind if I just like try to get this solution out real quick? And then we'll come back, because now you can go research for an hour and I can tinker for an hour and then let's come back together.
Yeah.
It's just, I'm watching teams transform and progress so much faster in honestly, as a researcher, in unpredictable ways.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have predicted how quickly they're getting through their backlogs and solving problems.
That's great. That's great. So we're back in the workplace.
We are back.
We are back.
I think I was going to clap, but not for that.
That is physically we are back in the workplace, but we are in our conversation back in the workplace.
Yes.
And so I really wanted to make sure we got in during our time together today your ideas on what can the hetero world do?
Okay.
Okay. And I think specifically our audience is going to be hetero women, largely. So what do you want them to know? Because a lot of times we don't know what we don't know. What do you want them to know about how they can be the best ally they can be for the LGBTQ+ community?
I love this. I love this question. And I've definitely had some time to think about it. As we think about our workplaces, as we think about our teams, it's for me, it is so important to have tough conversations. And we're not all versed at that, right? If we're not facing it head on, if we're not changing it, we're choosing it, right? So we have to have these tough conversations. It doesn't mean you have to have them alone. There are so many amazing trained facilitators to have these talks with. There are resources in this community, and I'll throw my hat in the ring to be one of them. To have these talks and start diagnosing what's really happening on your team. I told you that 40% of your people don't feel like they belong. Guess what happens when they feel like they belong? They're 3.5 times more productive in their role.
Yeah. So what are the softball pitches to get the managers there to making people feel like they belong? Well, these can be hard, fast pitches. They can be curveball pitches.
Yeah.
Do you have any softball pitches that you'd like to throw out there?
One of the things I normally do is say, hey, when's the last time you had one-on-ones with your people? Honest one-on-ones. When's the last time you just asked them how they were doing?
Yeah.
Right? Getting into that second and third order diversity and inclusion pieces. Like, you know, not the first, not the superficial.
Not what's on your to-do list.
Yeah.
Where are you on goals and objectives?
Exactly right. Like, when have you had an honest conversation with them? Second thing is, you know, get a group together. If you're wondering what women at your organization feel like, if you're wondering what the LGBTQ plus people at your organization feel like, or what the perception is, get a group to talk about it.
And sometimes better to talk outside
Absolutely.
The walls of the office.
And it's sometimes better to have an objective outside party, right? To say, this isn't guided. I'm not trying to shape the conversation in some way. I'm not looking for an outcome. The deal is then being open to what you hear.
Right.
So diagnose, that's what, in this diagnostic phase, I want to genuinely know, even if it hurts me, what's actually going on. I want to tell you a story. And I want to tell you, it feels mundane. But if you're having the tough conversations, a manager would know what's actually happening. One of the conversations that I had with an individual who got hired at an engineering firm here, she was like, hey, we do this daily, we do a Monday ritual. It's called a stand-up. And you just talk about, what you did over the weekend, what you're going to work on this week, what are your blocks or barriers. It's pretty, it feels mundane. It is a ritual that we have in technology. Almost every shop I know does it. Well, she got into these rituals and she realized, man, everyone talks about like their very hardcore faith and their belief, and they went to church and they all hung out together and they did these things, and they're all talking about their husbands and or their wives. And so everyone in this ritual for me was heterosexual and had very, very strong religious beliefs. So her then, she was like, well, what do I say? Right? How do I act? Because she didn't feel safe.
Right.
So what actually happened was on Sunday night, she started having severe anxiety about what she needed to make up to say on Monday. So talk about not feeling like you belong. This person is like internalizing this so much, this lack of safety and lack of belonging, that she's lying now in her ritual, in this stand-up, just to avoid any kind of,
Confrontation,
discomfort on the team. Mm-hmm. But as a manager, I'm sure her body language gave a lot of that away, to be like, she's probably removed a little bit from the stand-up. She's probably not making eye contact. That's when you're like, hey, I need to have a conversation, because even something as mundane as this ritual or what feels natural for people in technology mm-hmm. was actually a very isolating behavior for this particular individual.
And so the solution?
Have the conversations.
Yeah.
Hey, what's going on? I just wanted to check in with you. How's everything going? Get to know your people.
Yeah.
And that's not easy when you're a manager or a leader of an organization that has hundreds of people underneath you. But be intentional about it. So one of the things that I always said, and we kind of had this conversation, is go first. Mm-hmm. If you want, I just said, if there were not safe spaces around me, I became one. Go first. Make sure people know you are safe.
And that goes back to the whole leadership philosophy of making yourself vulnerable,
yeah,
then engenders the trust.
Absolutely.
That you are looking for from your people.
Absolutely. One of the stories that, personal stories that I have speaking to that is actually when I took my first job, right out of school, I got this PhD, ooh, doctors coming in, right? Whatever. But I realized going into my first job that everyone already had their presuppositions about what a psychologist or a person with a PhD in psychology would mean for the organization. Like, is she going to be analyzing me? Why is she here?
She's the resident.
Yeah. Why is she here? What is she going to learn about me? What don't I want her to know about? Right. And I realized there was like this weird, there's like myth status, and there was these kind of weird rumors. And I just felt a general sense of anxiety about me coming on board. So I made it intentional. I was so intentional. I went around to every single person and introduced myself. Right. Just made sure, hey, how's it going? I just wanted to say, I'm really happy to work here. What do you do here? Hey, if you'd love to grab coffee or lunch sometime. I just wanted to make sure they all realized I wasn't
your person.
that I wasn't here to tell on them, weed them out, whatever.
Psychoanalyze
them. Whatever story they were telling themselves, I wanted to just preemptively squash it.
Right.
And become accessible, become vulnerable, in that sense, it's exactly what I just said. Go first.
Mm-hmm.
Be the safe space. And I developed amazing relationships with these people who confided in me, who produced great work. Who, I mean, it just, it becomes a, it's a camaraderie that you develop when you're just willing to go first.
Right. Well, I know that you have put yourself out there also in the community as someone, not only as a safe space, but as a resource. You've said that several times today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know you started Tech Equals.
I did.
Which is really interesting, and I'd love to for you to share more about that with our audience. But also, if someone needs access to you, would like your advice, would like some of your resources,
yeah. You
know, how do they go about doing that?
Absolutely can reach me through Tech Equals on Instagram. It's tech.equals. I am still active in Two Ravens, through Hidden Innovators, LinkedIn. Reach out on LinkedIn for sure. But yes, Tech Equals is Central Alabama's first LGBTQ plus professional organization for tech and tech adjacent individuals, you know, who are in these roles in companies that are tech and tech adjacent. I am so big on visibility and knowing that there are people like you that also work in these organizations. I have had the experience where some people are not out yet and they have not fully come out. So we have a lot of supporters in the background, which I'm super thankful for. But we have a ton of people who are so ready to not worry about, you know, can I put a picture of my partner on my desk? Can I bring my partner to the Christmas party? You know, can I hug them in public if I'm in our public parking lot, you know, because they're dropping me off at work? Mm-hmm. Can I have lunch with them and it not feel weird or me not get stared at? Or so there's this constant dialogue that's happening for a lot of queer women, queer men. And I really wanted an organization that helped leverage the resources and network that we currently have in the community, but also provide, again, a larger safe space that they're not alone in technology and in the tech adjacent industry. But also as we see things like Magic City Acceptance Academy come into the community, I wanted very young and, you know, middle school, high school kids to know that tech is an option for them.
Yeah.
Right? That, you know, there's so many great opportunities and there's so many things happening. There's so many roles. There's so many jobs. I wanted them to feel like this was not out of reach for them as well.
Right. Like, you don't have to be a software engineer to work in tech.
There's so many things. So I felt like, hey, if there's an organization and they can say, wow, look at this diversity.
Yeah.
There are people like me in tech, and I really love tech, then hopefully that would be another opportunity for bridge building.
Yes. Amazing.
Yeah. I know. There's so much going on.
Yes. Well, I thank you for taking the time to be with us this afternoon.
I loved it.
And to share these ideas with our audience. We've got a lot more coming up on future podcasts with Pride Month and other leadership topics. So I'm excited to dive into those. And congratulations on your recent graduation from the Momentum program.
Thank you.
So
highlight of my year. I love it.
Yeah, fantastic. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah.
And allowing me to have this conversation publicly and be a bit vulnerable with everyone here.
Thank you. That's important. It's important to us. So
thank you.
The Momentum Matters podcast would not be possible without our sponsors. Please visit our website, momentumleaders.org/sponsors, to learn more. Signing off, this is Karen Tarotis from Social You.